New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos. You can now download a free PDF copy or purchase a beautiful printed edition of Issue 5 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Today we are exploring the topic of living with guidance. My guest is Frederick Holmes Atwater, also known as Skip. As an Army lieutenant, he is the one who took the initiative that resulted in the creation of the Remote Viewing Intelligence Program we now remember as Stargate. After he left the Army, he later became president of the Monroe Institute in Virginia, founded by Robert Monroe, author of Journeys Out of the Body. Skip is author of Captain of My Ship, Master of My Soul, which is now in its second edition. He lives in Virginia, and now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Skip. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm excited about this.
We've got a lot to talk about when I consider your long career. You've been involved in this field at least as long as I have been, which is around half a century. But your story actually begins even earlier than that, because unlike me, and unlike most people, you had a childhood which was imbued with an appreciation for invisible influences that help us.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Very interesting childhood when I look back, but it was my childhood. It was normal at the time, of course.
Let's, for example, talk about your mother, who, among her other talents, was a healer.
Yes, it was very interesting, but again, there was a sense that, wasn't everybody that way? I mean, wasn't everybody's mom like my mom? And so she was able to do things, which now I can speak of. I'm older now than she was when she died, and so it's interesting to reflect back on what to me was normal as a kid, and the way she told me things. And I was like, okay, sounds good to me. I'm going to go out and play now, you know, kind of a thing. So it was a very normal situation for me.
And I gather part of it had to do with your father was a Christian Scientist. You grew up in the Unity Church and then the Church of Religious Science. So you always, I guess, had a sense that the paranormal is very normal. That was deeply imbued in you.
That's an interesting way of stating it. I now have a belief system that it was the agenda of my life. It wasn't as though I was taught that, or it was, to me, your use of the word imbued, was it because of the behavior of my parents? It was pushed into me, and that they created me by their counsel. I think it was more of a, that was the agenda of my life, and we all worked together to fulfill that agenda.
Fair enough. I can tell you, I felt like my life has been shaped by guidance as well, but I had a very different childhood. There was really almost no sense of the supernatural until I got older. When after I left home and went off to college, my mother became a yoga teacher.
Oh, okay.
So it happened sort of belatedly in my own family, but then at the same time, I think it's fair to say when I look at the whole field of remote viewing that many of us seem to have been guided. I did a lengthy interview with Russell Targ, for example, who talked about a huge series of synchronicities that led to the formation of the research program at SRI International.
A series of synchronicities. That's a very interesting way to state it. You know, it was in the plan, you know, kind of a thing. Yes.
In my case, some of the guidance was very explicit, but it came in dreams. And as explicit as it was still rather roundabout.
Mm-hmm. Had to wait for absorption of the information.
But at any rate, after having this unusual childhood, you ended up in the Army, and I gather that the reason you enlisted was to avoid the draft.
That was part of it. I had a couple of years of college by that time and was going around. I worked for a company called Haggerty's down in L.A., and they had 9 different stores, and I learned later that the only reason that they had that is the wife of the owner liked to buy clothing on discount. And so they had 9 stores in Southern California, which were millions and millions of dollars then, so that she could buy clothing on discount. And right now, I can't figure that out. Anyway, I worked there and I went shopping for other jobs. I wanted to get involved in a sort of training program in other retail stores. And I had this little background I was working on. And the question was always, well, what's your draft status? And I was like, well, I'm 1A right now, but I'm going to go down to UCLA and sign up in UCLA, and that'll protect me for a while. And as long as I said 1A at that time, they said, I'm sorry, we can't hire you, because we would be required to hold that job for you even while you were gone away in the Army. And so after talking to several different retail stores, I said, I know how to solve this problem. You know, if I enlist in the Army, then they can't come calling and saying, it's your time. We've decided to put you in the Army because you don't have any deferments anymore. But I was going to fool them. I was going to join the Army. So I went to a recruiter in Glendale, California, and walked into the recruiter and said, I can't seem to get a job because I'm a 1A classification, so I think it'd be better if I just joined the Army. And he says, well, what do you want to do in the Army? And I said, I have no idea. I just want to be able to get a job without the government hanging over me. And he said, well, look over there at all these different brochures we have and see if you see something there that attracts you that you'd like to do. And I did, and I picked up this, and I picked up that, and I was sort of, my eye caught a blue-colored little, you know, three-folding thing, and it said Army Intelligence. And so I picked that up, and I said, this looks interesting. What's this about? And he says, oh, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you about that. Really? What do you mean you can't talk to me about it? It's one of your brochures. And he said, well, if you want to talk to somebody about that, I can make an appointment with you with some agents down in Los Angeles. But you'll have to go to that appointment and talk to them about making an application. And I was like, well, yeah, I'll do that. Let's make that appointment. So that was the designation of my future. I was going to join to avoid the draft. And I would do, if you were drafted, you were required to go for 2 years in the draft. And I spent the next 20 years in the Army. So I guess I took care of that problem.
Over time, you became an intelligence officer. You were advanced again and again. You served in Korea. You served in Panama. And somewhere along the line, as you're going through, if I remember rightly, you were getting more advanced training in Arizona when you came across the book Mind Reach by Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff, and that seemed to be something of a turning point for you.
Yes. When I was in Korea, my annual requirement in Korea, they let you put in what we call a dream sheet, like you're going to list where you want to go. And it's like, it's a dream sheet because nobody would really look at this. I mean, after all. And by that time, I had a couple of college degrees and was actually teaching college in Korea to other soldiers. And then I decided that I'd really like to go back to the intelligence school, which was down in Arizona, Fort Huachuca, Arizona, because I'd been in the Army 10 years now, and I had personal experience with all these things, and I'd like to share all those personal experiences with the school down there. And plus, it's a nice place to live and so forth and so on. So sure enough, the dream came true, like it wasn't planned, you know, ahead. The dream came true, and I wound up down there and stumbled across Mind Reach by Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff. And by that time, I had specialized in lots of investigations and counterintelligence prevention and so forth and so on. And the stories I read about in Mind Reach were about this thing they called remote viewing, which turns out it's like remote viewing. They're talking about you do this, and you understand, and you can see other things and not see with these eyes, but with something else. I said, I do that. They have a name for that called remote viewing. Well, that's kind of interesting. So I began to talk to my friends there, Rob Cowart, and we said, you know, there's a problem here. There's a hole in our system of counterintelligence. We aren't checking on this. And if what's in this book, Mind Reach, is true, we need to do something else. So I was going to go from there to become another little story is, there was a Lieutenant Ray there who's become a great friend of mine now, but he used to walk in every day while I was teaching at the instruction, various and sundry subjects out at Fort Huachuca. Every day he'd walk in and he said, Captain Atwater, what are you doing here? And I said, well, sir, I wanted to do this, and I'm teaching a class this afternoon and one tomorrow afternoon too. And he said, I told you, you ought to go to OCS. You have 2 college degrees. You have 10 years of experience here. What are you doing here? And so he would irritate me like that a couple of times a week, trying to poke at me. You need to go do something other than this. So sure enough, I made an application and I got accepted to go. And then the colonel called me and he said, I used to be in assignments and I'm impressed with what you've done while you're here at the school. What would you like to do when you get commissioned as a lieutenant and you come back here? What do you want to do then? And I said, well, sir, I have this book, and I held it up. It's called Mind Reach, and it's about a different kind of technology where people can find out information in a different way that we haven't done yet. And I think we're missing a big part of our job. I mean, it's our responsibility to check on this stuff. And he said, well, I have no idea what this is. I'll keep this overnight if you don't mind. Please make an appointment with my secretary to come back tomorrow and we'll talk about this. And I said, yes, sir. I'll be back tomorrow. And so when I came back the next day, he said, you're right. If this is true, if this is what's really happening, we need to do something about this. We need to expert ourselves in this. He said, what if you keep your nose clean, graduate from the course at Fort Benning, come back here as a lieutenant, we'll get you assigned to the Pentagon. You see, in the Pentagon as a lieutenant, at night you'll run security teams and you'll have all access to the whole Pentagon to check on people to make sure that they have the proper security. Go find this program. I said, yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'll take care of that. So time passed. I went on, went back, came back, got the assignment to go to the Pentagon. And one day, it was actually the day I was ready to leave Arizona and drive to the Pentagon. And I was like, oh, man, I'm a lieutenant, and living anywhere near in Washington, D.C., and anywhere near the Pentagon is a long drive. It's very expensive. And how am I going to take care of my wife and kids and so forth and so on? So it was like, well, this is what I wanted to do. This was the plan. I was going to go do this. And so the phone call rang before I could leave. Said, Lieutenant Atwater, yes, this is Captain so-and-so from Fort Meade, Maryland, and I've got a change of orders for you. And I said, well, I have paper orders in my hand going directly to the Pentagon. She says, no, I have orders for you to come here to Fort Meade, Maryland. And she said, you just drive right to me and I will hand you those orders when you get to Maryland and we'll get you started. And I said, yes, ma'am, I'll do that. And I was like, guess what? I went home and told my wife, we don't have to go to the Pentagon. We're going to go to Fort Meade, Maryland. It's nothing but a big golf course. It's great. They have housing for you and it's a beautiful place to be. And when we got there, I found out that I was supposed to go to work for a special operations detachment, which was work for very secret information, what we call behind the green door, had to have special security clearances and so forth. And that was the real beginning. I didn't know it at the time, but it was real beginning of what MindReach was all about. Because on the drive and the excitement to get a job here at Fort Meade rather than at the Pentagon, I'd forgotten about all my aspirations on that and all these things I talked about and all that I was going to do, because I'd rather take care of my family and live on that nice place.
If I remember rightly, shortly thereafter, a synchronicity occurred when you were given your first desk of your own, and I gather a safe along with the desk, and there you found secret documents relating to remote viewing.
That's correct. I had to wait a while when I got to see Major Keenan, who was the boss of this office I was going to go to. Said, we can't have you here behind the green door because we haven't got all your security clearances straightened out yet and make sure that's all okay and everything. So he says, just go home and I'll probably call you in a couple of weeks and then you can come in. And so that happened. I think it was 3 weeks later. And all I did was, you know, play with the kids and find out where everything was in the area and so forth and so on. And then he says, okay, it's time for you to come in now and get read in on and follow all the rules and so forth and so on. Then he said, you're going to need an office. And Lieutenant Scottsco used to be in that office right down there, and that's going to be your office now. So I went into Lieutenant Scottsco's office, and it was like, you know, open the drawers and the desks and pull them out and paper clips and leftover papers and so forth and so on, just like you would take regular stuff when you left. Then I started opening the drawers of the safe behind me and pulled the top drawer out. Yeah, empty folders. Used to have stuff in here. They're just folders now. Second drawer, third drawer, fourth drawer. And I pulled the fifth drawer open and said, wait a minute, he must have left these in here. And I pulled them out and they were three classified documents on remote viewing. And I'm like, how did this happen? How did all circuitously, I went all through all of these loops and wound up in an office that was all about remote viewing. And I took them into Major Keenan and said, "Sir, I found these documents in the bottom drawer here, are secret documents. What do you want me to do with them?" And he said, "What are they about?" And he said, "Oh yeah, these are all the remote viewing stuff and what's going on in Russia and everything." And I said, "Yes, sir, that's what I understand too." And he says, "Well, do you know anything about that?" And I said, "Well, yes, sir, I do." He said, "Well, Lieutenant, you're in charge of it from now on." And it's like, goodness sakes. And so I didn't know what that meant, but he thought that he had found somebody, just because I said, "I know what this stuff is," that he found somebody to be in charge of it, because Lieutenant Scotso is gone now. So
that was at a point in time where the military had intelligence reports about parapsychology at SRI and in Russia, but the military wasn't yet doing anything about it.
Yes. Since you're saying the word military, they weren't doing anything about it. You didn't ask about things you can't ask about, but the military wasn't doing anything about it.
I mean, it's well known at this point that SRI was being funded by the CIA.
Oh, I didn't tell you that.
No, it was an open secret. And in fact, I had my first remote viewing experience at SRI in 1976.
Oh, my goodness.
Even before MindReach came out. The parapsychology community in the San Francisco Bay Area was very well aware of what was going on. And we assumed, of course, that the government had everything under control.
That is an assumption, I'll tell you.
But let's go back a little bit, because if I remember your book correctly, while you were in Korea, you were stationed in the demilitarized zone. And one of your concerns was that the barracks and other installations, American military installations, might have spying devices, bugs. And one of your jobs was to search for any bugs, I suppose, coming from North Korea. And you describe how you would go into a building and go into a state of consciousness that sort of expanded your mind so you could become aware of things that weren't readily apparent to the senses. And this was normal for you.
But I didn't tell anybody about it at the time. I would just sort of scope around, and I don't want to get into too much detail, but it would be easy to say something that isn't some spooky or strange thing and just say, "You know, if I were going to put a bugging device here, I'd put it right up there where somebody could find it, and I'd put another one over there, and they would be so happy they found it, they were sure it was just fine." And then they never did find that one over there. So, and it would be sound quite logical to people if I just said, "If I were to do this, it might be there and could do this and could do that," but didn't tell them. I was kind of scoping it out on a different level.
I imagine it's fair to say that not just in the military, but in many different professions, people who are successful at what they do seem to have a sixth sense, or a highly developed intuitive ability, we could say.
Yes, that's a very nice, safe way to say it, a highly developed intuitive ability. That's a very nice way to say that.
You probably don't know, I used to be the president of an organization called the Intuition Network, and many consultants working in business to help enhance intuitive abilities. And of course, intuition is a large subject, but at the heart of it really is psychic functioning, I think. Yeah, we don't want to say that too loudly. So at some point, it dawned on you that if the Soviets, in the era of the Soviet Union, if they were using remote viewing against U.S. targets, that we needed to develop some sort of a defense for that.
In the chain of things we've been talking about, that was another surprise to me, because what I did as a team, we would go to different Army installations and inspect them with a threat assessment, and we would be able to tell them when the Soviet satellites were flying over and how they were standing on that hill with their binoculars looking at what you were doing and trying to go into the bars and listen to the soldiers talk about something they did that was secret. And so we would go and run a inspection for them where we would investigate all these things. Were they locking their safes? They know not to talk on the phone because you can listen in on the phone. Not to talk in public. When you left the base, walked out, you're not supposed to talk about the things you do and so forth and so on. And one of the inspections we did was at Redstone Arsenal, Alabama, which is where they fire all the rockets off. And so we didn't want the Soviets with their satellites watching the rockets, listening to the radio communications between the rockets and the ground. And so we would be able to tell them with Satran reports, between the hours of this and the hours of that, don't test your rockets because they can listen in on you. And of course, since Redstone Arsenal, Alabama is really close to the Gulf Coast, they had ships that would come real close and tune their antennas, pointing them right down there. And so we told them about that. And you can know when those ships are down there and where their antennas are pointing. So we're giving them this big lecture at the end about all these things that we've checked into and telling the commander, because we're doing it as a service to the commander, that we will send you a full report on this and help find solutions for you for the things that we mentioned. We'll put that in our report. And he said, okay, fine. And you felt kind of we're getting to the end of our briefing there. And then there's a guy that stands up at the table and he said, yes, sir, what do you need? Well, I'm the director of so-and-so, and I want to know how to protect myself against this. And he slid Mind Reach across the table to me. And I picked up the book and I said, yes, sir, I understand why you began asking this question. However, we can't answer that for you right now in this briefing. It's a highly classified situation and we'll get back to you later. I made all that up because it hadn't even started yet.
To my knowledge, even today, 50 years later, we don't know how to protect against somebody using remote viewing to intrude on us or spy upon us.
There are deception methods that you can use. For example, if they're looking at a missile silo down underground and so forth and so on, and you ask somebody to remote view that, they have, you know, the ability to remote view that and saying and study that. Well, on Wednesdays, they have three people there, but every other Saturday, there's only two people there and so forth and so on. But if you create a birthday party with balloons and loud music down there while you know they're doing their remote viewing, they're going to come back and say, there's some kind of party. I don't know. This doesn't make any sense. This isn't a missile silo. There's some big party down here. Well, you get them then to not trust the perceptions of their remote viewer, even though that's really what was happening down there. They don't do that down there. That you're not doing too good today. Come back next week, you know, kind of a thing. So there are deception methods we can use.
If you know exactly when they're engaged in remote viewing.
Absolutely.
Oh, okay. Well, that's news to me. I had never thought of it quite that way. But eventually, these concerns reach higher and higher levels, and you met with generals. I think it was General Smith.
General Smith, at Fort Meade, where we were, General Smith was the deputy commander. And he was in charge of the budget. And so when my immediate boss, Major Keenan, said, well, how are you going to resolve this program? And I said, well, sir, we ought to use our own people here to do these remote viewings to test, is there a vulnerability to this unit, this specific unit, Redstone Arsenal? Should we need to use our people to do that? And he would say, well, why? The people out at SRI, they have several people that are proven to be good. Why should they? He said, because we're a classified organization and they aren't. They're hired by people to do this, which they have a natural talent. But we can't have them involved in the classified material at Army facilities. And he said, Lieutenant, I think you're right. How are you going to train those, Lieutenant? I said, well, sir, the first thing I'm going to have to do is go out to Stanford Research Institute and talk to them out there. And so I'll need to travel out there and get in contact with them and see how we can move on this situation. And he said, oh, well, we're about at the end of the budgetary things this year. You're going to have to brief General Smith about this and get this taken care of. Yes, sir. So I got all my books together and things like this and explained the best I could to General Smith. And since I was a brand new lieutenant, we had all these other people that were in my kind of a situation, lots of investigators and checkers and so forth and so on. They said, oh, General Smith, oh, you better be careful. He'll throw you out of there, and he'll do this, and he'll do this, and he never listens to anything we say, and he only wants this. And but I went in and, you know, spread everything out with the word secret written on it, and I said, sir, I'm here to talk to you about something that we're not taking care of that is a responsibility of the special detachment that we work for. It's part of what we do here, and you're the boss. We need to get involved in this thing called remote viewing. And I explained a little bit about it. And he said, is that really possible? And I said, yes, sir. And I picked up a book like I was going to hand it to him. He says, no, don't hand me that book. And he looked over at Major Keenan, and Major Keenan said, yes, he knows a great deal about this. Well, how much do you need? And I said, we only need a couple $1,000 to cover the next month to fly out there, talk to the people at Stanford who have published this book and explain it and so forth and so on. And he said, well, give me that paper. And so I dug it over, handed it to Keenan. Keenan handed it to the general and he signed it. And Keenan said to me, get out of here. So, so once we had the authority of that, I walked out the door. Yeah, with all my paperwork, because the next guy was waiting to come in and pitch them. Now, there was something else behind the scenes that I didn't know that Major Keenan knew. General Thompson was a two-star general then, and Smith was a one-star general. General Thompson was a two-star general, and he was the big boss. And he had been in contact with the CIA, and he really thought this remote viewing stuff was good stuff. So it really wasn't in the judgment of Smith. When he sat down there with me and listened to me and nodded and tried to be the tough guy and everything else, General Thompson had told him, whatever Atwater asked for, you give it to him. So it that became what we call in the military my grandfather. And Keenan was the exchange between. He would say, what's Atwater doing now? Well, we found six people, and we found this, and we're going to do this, and we're beginning to do this. Good. Keep Atwater moving on this. And the general and I never met, but I knew he was my grandfather all along.
So that moment was, in effect, the birth of the military remote viewing program that developed at Fort Meade.
Yes, when he gave the go-ahead, it was this two-star general, and he didn't want to be laughed at in the Pentagon or wherever at about it, but it was the official signed go create a program situation.
And so you flew out to SRI and met with Puthoff and Targ. This would have been 78, as I recall.
Yes, I believe so, too.
And they explained to you what how they worked.
Well, not so much. They're in business making money for SRI, right? And so I'm this young guy coming in. They don't know me. They don't know anything about what's going on. But I wanted to ask them about what this was and what they do. And we were looking at something that might be used for training. And he said, oh, we don't do any training here. All we do is run sessions with people and then test the validity of it from science. We don't do any training. And I said, oh, I see what you're talking about here. And which was money. So I see what you're talking about. Thank you. I'm going to look into this with my bosses and see what they have to say. So I fly back home and say, they have the expertise. They deal with people that are naturals that they have found, and they test naturals with different techniques and stuff, and then try to validate scientifically that whatever this natural psychic did. And so he said, well, do you think they would train some people for us? And so I wrote a very carefully worded letter, and I said, they were willing to do an evaluation, but not train. And so I was very careful to say, if we wanted to pick some people for you to evaluate, what might be the parameters of this? And we would enter into a contract about that. And he said, oh, money. Okay. Well, here are six things that you should know about trying to pick people and so forth and so on. And that became very helpful to us. So Keenan said, what do you want to do? I said, well, we need to establish an organization here at Fort Meade and recruit some people from INSCOM that aren't going to be transferred immediately, but they might be interested in doing something like this. And I said, well, and he said, oh, and by the way, I've found someone else. Major Watt is going to be your boss, and you're going to be his deputy. And I said, okay. And so Major Watt was very beneficial because he knew a lot of people around the Washington, D.C. area. And we went around and interviewed over 100 people and finally came down to about a dozen that we thought were might be interested. And the way we did those interviews is to establish a ruse of newspaper articles about psychics that had, you know, found murderers and found lost children and everything, and went to, we're doing a survey for the commander of INSCOM, and the survey is about this article. Do you see how this person helped the police? Do you see how this person, just newspaper articles? Do you think these people would be beneficial to help the intelligence system in any way? And someone would answer, these psychics are all crazy. This is insane. No, I don't want to know anything about that. That's really, yeah. And other people would say, well, you know, my grandmother was like that. This sounds like very interesting stuff here. So when I would interview someone, then I would switch with Major Watt, and he would interview that same person. And then we would get together and say, what's your vote about this person and this person? And we finally picked out, I think it was about 12 people, and then invited them under the ruse of the commander wants you to come and talk to us. And we took them into a secure area and said, sign these papers. You're not going to talk about this after we're talking to you. We would like to know if you want to volunteer to be part of this situation that we're developing, where we would see that you are trained properly in how to do this thing that's called remote viewing. And so that was another breaking point. It was very simple that we came up with a contract. Major Watt knew how to come up and create a contract and feed that over to Stanford Research Institute. And they wanted to come and talk to these people personally before they would approve anything. And they were at that point saying, well, we're going to do three people. So we set up interviews. They came to Fort Meade, the people that we had recruited, and Russell and Hal came, and they interviewed these people. And everybody shook hands, thank you very much, and so forth and so on. And then after the meeting, we kind of went out to lunch and talked to Russ and Hal. And they said, well, I know this was supposed to be a contract for three people that we were going to evaluate. And they seemed to have met your criterion. But Russell and I have talked, and we think we'd like to see six people. And we said, well, how much more is that going to cost than what we've already? He said, oh, no, there'll be no extra cost. We'd just like to see six people. So that was really the beginning. And they started rotating out to Stanford for the evaluation.
At that point, I gather it was up to you to actually develop a training program.
Yes, that I actually would have an official assignment written by the Army, officially assigning to me, I am the operations and training officer, whereas Major Watt was the boss. And so with that official written, printed, typed officially as my assignment in the Army, that was my responsibility to do that. Well, one of my degrees is in psychology. And so I went back to the old days of college and wrote out this big multi-stage thing, like I knew what I was talking about this is what you need to do to train people. You need to do this, you need to do this, you need to do this. And there are these steps and we need to train them for this length of time and so forth. And that was part of the job to say, I'm doing my job is, well, here's my paperwork. And they said, I have no idea what this paperwork says, but it looks like he's done it.
I gather that program that you developed actually was implemented for a while.
That's correct. That was the beginning of the training. And they, out at Stanford Research Institute, the thing they did there was to keep their person that they were going to evaluate back at the Stanford campus. And then someone would get a secret destination randomly chosen and drive away to some place in the general area. And then you, the remote viewer, were back at the office, totally blind to what was going on. Just describe where this person is now. And so then they would come back and they would do something called blind.
I think the term was judging.
That's judging the situation. And so they would have six different sites picked out. Totally, only one of them was the actual remote viewed site, hopefully. So with these six things, they had a judge who wasn't aware of what was going on go through with blind discrimination of, well, it doesn't seem like that one. It seems a little like that one, but how about that one over here? And they would pick out the one that they thought was the most likely, that this matches best. And so then that was the score that the evaluation score that our trainees, no, they're being evaluated, no trainees, did. And so they were very impressed. There were some people, there were three of the people that they asked to come back again. So three of them came back and they all came back and they said, we'd like to see these three people again for some advanced evaluation. Meanwhile, we began that same kind of practice back at Fort Meade. We would have someone drive out to a site, and then we would, I guess it was first Major Watt, he would be assigned to go out and go someplace. And then back at the office, I was the one, the operations officer, who would interview somebody about describing and teaching by the methods that I had come up in teaching, being calm and relaxed and describe, do not name, don't guess, don't wonder, just give your impressions of where they are. And that became our first training mission out at in Fort Meade, copying what they had done in Stanford.
Now, my understanding of the situation at SRI isn't that they always worked with natural psychics. I understand that many of the people who went through their program were government contract monitors who were sent from Washington to see what was going on at SRI. And they would, in order to convince the contract monitor that this was legitimate, they would have that person who had no background in psychic functioning at all do the remote viewing. And I was such a person myself, although at the time I was not a contract monitor. I was a college student with no particular background in remote viewing. But Russell Targ in particular seemed to have a gift to, when he tells people you can do it, you believe him.
Yes, it's a very, that's an interesting part of, let's imagine for a minute, you know, you pull somebody off the street. Listen, I want you to sit down, close your eyes, and describe where so-and-so is. And they're like, what? That's the craziest thing I ever heard of. So not believing it's possible is not a mechanism that's going to work too well. But believing with someone gentle with you that's dealt with other people that said, because he in his own mind, Russell in his own mind, had seen it happen so many times. It says, you know, you can do this thing. And just the right tone of voice, and you're like, whoa, he said I could do this thing. And you can. There's, I, with all the different techniques that are out there now in the 2024, the only right way to do it is the one that's the successful way. You know, I want to do this. I want to wear this color shirt when I do it. Or with Hella, I want to wear my secret socks when I do this. And with Price, if I take my glasses off, I can see better. You know, that kind of a thing. So we're not going to say, no, you have to keep your glasses on. We're going to say, whatever works is the best way.
You continued in that position as the officer in charge of operations and training for 10 years.
That's correct. I spent 10 years at Fort Meade doing that.
And during that time, I gather there was quite a bit of evolution in terms of the training.
Yes, there was. I obviously, there's a proper expression for that, but I learned by doing. You know, I had academically written up this thing that I'd learned in college about doing these kinds of trainings and stuff. But working with people and learning what works successfully and dealing with people, you could say I learned while doing. I also think there was a little guidance involved in helping me along in that situation as well.
At one point, I assume while you were still there, Ingo Swann came into the picture.
Absolutely. I was there because SRI, we were pestering SRI because we knew Ingo Swann was really good, and we'd seen lots of good things he did. Pat Price had been hired by the CIA at that time and wasn't under the purview of SRI anymore. But Ingo was there. And so we kept saying, won't Ingo train the way he does it? You know, he really gets good stuff back. Why don't he train? And so Hal started kind of pestering Ingo. You know, you really, can you kind of write down what are the specific things that you do? the army would pay for that, you know, if you do that. And so they eventually talked Ingo into doing that. And then we paid and we had the pipeline to create contracts through General Thompson to pay SRI for stuff. And if we said we'd like to pay them to have this happen, and then SRI hired Ingo to develop the program, which he called controlled remote viewing, or sometimes people call it coordinate remote viewing. And it turned out actually to be a wonderful program to capture how does he do that. Now, again, there's not the perfect way to do it, and people do it differently under different techniques. But this was one tool where people not always picked up on it. There were people who just couldn't get it. You know, I don't do very well at getting high math either, but it worked for many people, and there are today people who use that technique. And since we understand how it's developed and what the signal line means and what AOL means and so forth and so on, it's easy for an analyst to look at it and see the pathway that this guy was going in developing the information.
We should talk a little bit about your life after you left the military. You, after serving for 20 years, you left and went over to the Monroe Institute.
I have to tell a backstory, a funny thing about that. When I got the orders to go to Fort Meade, stop by my parents' house, I think. I don't think we stopped by. I think it was a phone call. I said, well, we're not going to the Pentagon. We're going to go to Fort Meade. We're going to be in Maryland. Oh, my mother said, oh, you're going to be on the East Coast? Well, you ought to look up some guy named Bob Monroe. He's on the East Coast. And so here I am, you know, 30 years old, thinking there's millions of people on the East Coast, and I'm supposed to look up somebody named Bob Monroe, and I have no idea who a Bob Monroe is, and so forth and so on. But as guidance would have it, I looked up Bob Monroe and went to his programs, and I thought, you know, this is really interesting. And when I retired, then I went down to work at the Monroe Institute. Now, I had established a relationship with him because Joe McMonagle, one of my best remote viewers ever, said, you're sending these other people to training here and other people to training here. And being a warrant officer in the Army, they always have something called advanced training. You know, your basic training, and then you get your MOS training, and then there's always some additional training. Like when I learned to look for bugging devices, that was an additional training that I had. And I said, okay. And because he was what we call the type of person doesn't do Ingo Swan work. He lays down and gets into a meditative state to do his remote viewing. There's a nickname for that these days called ERV, or extended remote viewing. There's a funny story behind that too. But at any rate, the minute he said, I want to do some training thing. And I said, well, you're due that. You got a couple of years until you're going to retire. But you're right. Military people should have a stab at advanced training. Maybe you won't retire because of this. So I worked out a situation with Bob Monroe. I'd been to a couple of his programs, and I'm saying, oh, I got a secret security clearance for him through a national agency check request, and went down and said, actually, Bob, I am the operation training officer for something called remote viewing. And he said, well, I've heard of remote viewing. You're the operations and training officer for that? And I said, yes, Bob, that's my hangout here a lot. And I said, I've got someone I'd like you to work with personally. Now, I don't mean just go to your programs. I want you to work with him personally. And he'd say, well, I don't know who this person is and so forth. I said, well, does that sound like something you might be interested in? He said, well, maybe, but why doesn't he just go to a program? And I said, because I have some special needs. And he said, well, okay. And I said, well, in a couple of weeks, I'll give you a call and let you know. So then I went back and talked to Joe, and I said, would you be interested in doing this? He said, well, sure, I'll meet with him. Meanwhile, I got another contract of secret money and a contract to sign in a check for secret money, and went back down with Joe and Bob, and they introduced each other. And I said, this is the person that I'd like you to work with in training. But you personally, well, what I'd like you to do is develop some sound technology, your binaural beat sound technology, that would work very best with Joe, not necessarily one of your programs, but he has done this work very successfully, and we want to see if you can advance this. It can, what you do with your HemiSync would help Joe in this particular situation.
We better define for our viewers what HemiSync is.
Sure. HemiSync was something that Bob Monroe became interested in before he moved to Virginia. And the idea was to put one sound in one ear and one sound in the other ear, slightly different, like 100 cycles per second here and 104 cycles per second here. And when your brain calculates those two signs, it hears, it thinks it hears, not two signals, but a wah, 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 wah sound. And if you mix together, that would habituate, just one sound would habituate quite easily. But if you mix together four different sounds, for example, then it would actually change the level of your brain's homeostasis. We all try to reach a calm homeostasis in a yoga situation or a baseball situation or playing a card game. You're in a certain stasis of that. That's who you are, what you're thinking about. And this binaural beating can change that level, that homeostasis. And Bob Monroe called those focus levels. Focus level one is wide awake and alert. Focus level 10 is you're kind of getting a little bit sleepy and you're drifting off. Focus 12 is you're beginning to be aware of things around you. It doesn't make you do things, but it sort of helps get you into that state. Now, my thinking at the time when working at the table with Bob and Joe, I'm saying, I want you to play with those different sounds and find ones that we might think that maybe helps Joe get into the right state of mind for his remote viewing. We don't know what the right state of mind is, but we're going to go play with this for a little bit as part of Joe's. So I'm getting something from it, and Joe's getting his advanced training. So he said, well, how are we going to do this? And he said, and I got my briefcase out. And I said, well, all you need to do is sign this contract that we have. And then I'll give you this check for $25,000. And he was like, well, I'd be glad to sign that contract for you. And so for 1 year, 1 week at a time, he'd come back to Fort Meade. And he'd go down on a Friday. I would go down and run a validation session with him. And then the next month he'd come down, go through another validation session and try to use up this year of things that I'd bought a week at a time. And I have several of those sessions that he did as YouTube things and other collection items of videos that were taken and sounds that were recorded.
We will link to your website, captainofmyship.com, where people can view those videos.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That'd be good. So that was the depth of my experience with him. Other people have heard about that training and have wanted to go themselves, even now, down to see whether the Monroe thing works. And I said, it isn't a magic turn on the switch for remote viewing, but you're going to have a good time anyway, because, you know, doing a Monroe group just makes you think about the world around you differently.
So after you left the Army, though, you went back to the Monroe Institute.
Yeah, when I had done my 20 years in the Army, I said, I have other things to do now. And so I went down to the Monroe Institute and eventually became the research director down there. And I spent 25 years at the Monroe Institute. And so I had a whole lot of exposure to the various programs, as well as I was able to participate in the various programs as well.
As I recall, many years ago, you invited me to come there as a speaker and to experience the HemiSync process. And I've been through the Monroe trainings myself, and for whatever reason, I've never had an out-of-body experience yet, although I've always enjoyed the interactions with the Monroe Institute.
You're on a path of your own doing something extremely important. It's just, don't let him out of his body. He'll lose track of what he's doing now.
Yeah, it seems as if I'm where I need to be.
Yes, yes.
And I love it. I've been guided, and I'm still going strong after 50 years. I'm not ready to retire yet. But I gather you are now retired from the Monroe Institute as well.
Yes, for 10 years.
You can look back over a very long and interesting career. And I guess if I had to assume what you're thinking, when you look back over your career, maybe one word that comes up for me is guidance itself.
Yes, I would agree with that. Yes, I agree. Now, however, at my senior position, I would say now at my age, and I'm getting so old, but now having experienced this big chunk of life, the things my mother told me when I was young about this and that and the other thing was like, yeah, okay, Mom, okay. Now I'm like, I live in that space. I mean, I'm all about consulting and dialoguing and sharing with my wife. Last night, this, and this. And she said, oh, that's interesting, because I thought this, and this. And so it's, my brain was trying to put words in my mouth saying, it's like this now. But it's always been like this. They didn't realize it, but it's always been like this.
As I recall from your book, your mother, as a child, used to tell you, you will always be protected.
Yes, yes, I remember that, yes.
And I think looking back now, you probably fair to say she was right.
Yes, and now I would argue with her about the word protected, because there's nothing to be protected from. You are doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing. So
I know I hear from viewers occasionally who think that life is horrible. They'd rather be dead. I do. I hear from people. They're probably suicidal.
I understand. I'm familiar with the issue. My daughter is a psychologist and a counselor, and works with clients in horrible situations. But she's aware and knows methods of working with them about that. The challenge for people, it's actually not a challenge, I shouldn't say that. My wife and I have an expression that say arrangements are made. because you're not disconnected from your spiritual self. You are still your spiritual self having a human experience. You are never disconnected from that spiritual self. And that arrangements have been made for what's going on. Now, if you hit your thumb with a hammer while you're trying to nail something in, you're like, ah, 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 ah. I'm sorry, but arrangements were made. There's a reason you did that. You may hate it because it hurts now, but I have a great deal of faith that arrangements are made for everything. There's no time, there's no space. Everything is arranged.
That's a very profound statement, Skip. And I know there's a lot more depth to this discussion. We've been talking largely about remote viewing. I know that going back to your childhood, your mother, as I understand it, conversed with the deceased. And Robert Monroe, since he has died, has still been, from the other side, an active force in the your work and in the work of the Institute.
Yes, he has come back. He connected with me in a cute story. And I'll tell you a little story about me, and then I'll tell you a little story about the people in the program. I was assigned to go up to the hilltop. They have two facilities at the Monroe Institute, the Nancy Penn Center, and then where Bob used to live, his daughter turned that into an additional center up there. And there were some visitors coming and wanted to go up on the hill and see what the new center was up there where Bob used to live. And so my job was to go up there and open up all the doors and, air it out and make sure everything was okay for the visitors to come up. And so I got up there and parked my car and so forth and so on. And then I walked over to the door and the door was locked. And so I walked to the back, and this is before cell phones. And I was like, so where is the key? And Bob spoke to me as clear as I'm talking to you now and said, it's on the window to the left of the door on the windowsill. And so I walked over there and there it was. And I opened the door and so forth and so on. Now, I didn't say, oh, Bob Monroe talked to me. Oh, Bob Monroe talked to me. I was more interested in getting the door unlocked. And it was such a very, because of the family I grew up in, that wasn't a strange thing. On one time on my computer, I was the research guy on a computer, and a warning came up on the computer. There's no end to data. And I'm like, that isn't in the, it isn't a glitch on the computer that says, you've entered too much data now. There is no end to data. It was a message from Bob. And so now down to people in a program, they go, you've been to programs, but they go and they go off to their little check unit rooms, put the headphones on, have an experience, and they come back downstairs and they gather together and they talk about what they experience. And you're encouraging them. Is there anything anybody wants to say? Is there anything, what experience did you have? And people will say interesting things like, well, I saw Mary on my thing. And Mary said, really? Yeah. She said, don't you remember standing near the pine tree? And you knew about me standing by the pine tree, you know? And so those are cute little things. And this other lady was kind of like this. And I said, so Jill, tell me, it seems like you have something. She says, well, I don't think it's very important. Doesn't make any sense. I said, well, why don't you tell us about it and we'll see what you have to say. She said, well, I met this old guy that was carrying a dog. And well, what kind of a dog was it? Well, it was a little white dog. And so we're like, Bob loved his dog. I can't remember the name right now, but he loved this dog.
Steamboat.
Yeah, it was probably Steamboat. That's right. But he didn't say, well, she didn't come back with Steamboat, but he was carrying that little dog. And I said, well, what is the message this old man with the dog said? And she said, all he said is you should have fun with this. And so she said, that isn't really very important. That doesn't make any sense to me, except to us. The trainers that were up front were like, oh, because Bob would always say that, you know, this ought to be fun. And we didn't say to them, the class, well, we think it's this. But when I tell this story, I cocked my head and I said, you know, you wouldn't think that's really so important. But wait a minute. Maybe that is the most important thing, is to have fun. So it was an arrangements were made for me to hear that differently than she heard it. So I enjoyed that. And yeah, Bob hasn't been in contact for years. There's concepts that people that pass think about, earthly things that they just did in the last few years, but then they pick up other agendas. I'm through with that. I got to go do something else now. You know?
Well, Skip Atwater, what a pleasure to hear this valuable piece of history that you have lived through, that you have contributed to, and that apparently was organized from another dimension. And I think there are many people who will attest to that.
I do. I agree.
Skip, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you. It's been an enjoyable thing for me as well.
It's been a real pleasure. And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday. New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.